Good afternoon. This is your host, Charles Cook, here of the Immigration Hour from Cook Baxter. It has been a little bit wild before since I posted a podcast because I got really sick. I ended up getting sepsis in mid-August, and I was out for more than 6 weeks recovering from that. My advice to you is never get sepsis. It's not a pleasant experience. Neither is staying in the ICU for 6 days. It's weird because I feel perfect now. I feel like nothing's happened. So it's great to be back. And of course, while I was gone, nothing happened. No immigration news whatsoever, obviously from Congress. I weren't doing anything. But today's episode, I want to focus on the new H-1B legislation that immigration proposed recently, because it is kind of not, I'm going to say it's not necessarily great news for people who are on H-1Bs or those that want to get H-1Bs. It carries with it some let's call it sludge from the Trump administration. But there's also some really telling things inside this modernization rule. That's what they call it, an H-1B modernization rule. And they start out by saying this, that the purpose is to modernize and improve regulations by streamlining the requirements of the program and improving program efficiency. By the way, these regulations don't do that. Providing greater benefits and flexibilities for petitioners and beneficiaries, maybe it does that. And improving integrity measures, it might do that, at least for the lottery. So here's what they propose. One, they're revising the regulatory definition and criteria for specialty occupation. We'll get into this in a second. This is actually one of the bad things that they're doing. The two, they clarify that normally does not mean always within the criteria for special occupation, because they kept losing this in federal court. So they're just reflecting reality. Three, clarifying that the position may allow a range of degrees, although there must be a direct relationship between the required degree and duties position, because the current rules don't require that. They don't require that. They've been taking that position for years and losing it consistently in court, but denying lots of people who didn't want to sue. So those are what they call the three streamline requirements for the program. They also clarify when an amended or new position must be filed to change a place of employment consistent with current policy guidance. Remember, what you're learning here in the regulations, that a lot of what USA has been doing on H-1Bs is just made up stuff, not based in regulations. Just exactly right. They're also doing one good thing, which has future potential benefits, and that's to codify and clarify its deference policy to state that if there's no material change in the underlying facts, adjudicators should generally defer to a prior determination involving the same parties and underlying facts. Now, they also propose to update the regulations to expressly require that evidence of maintenance of status must be included with the petition if they're seeking. So more births. So, I mean, what do you want to see? Do you want to see every pay stub for the last 2 years, 3 years? Is that what you want to see? Good question. We'll get into that in a little bit here. And they're saying that policy, by the way, impacts every employment-based non-immigrant. So O's, E's, L's, P's, they all require you to show that you have been maintaining your status. In other words, to prove a negative, that you haven't not maintained your status. Okay. They proposed to modernize the definition of employers who are exempt from the annual limit to create more flexibility for nonprofit and governmental research agencies not directly employed by the qualifying organization. They proposed specifically to change the definition of nonprofit resource organization and governmental research organization by replacing primarily engaged and primary mission with, quote, fundamental activity to permit a nonprofit entity or governmental research organization that conducts research as a fundamental activity, but it's not primarily engaged in that research or where it's not its primary mission. That actually is a good change, which will expand the scope of people that can qualify for H-1Bs not subject to the H-1B cap. They also propose in these regulations, a couple of parting shots, to automatically extend the duration of F-1 status and any employment granted under that until April 1 of the relevant fiscal year rather than October 1 of the same fiscal year to avoid disruptions in lawful status. Now, this is an interesting change, and we're going to get into this in a second, because at least the way they propose it, it's to codify what's called the cap gap, which would take somebody who, let's say their OPT is expiring in July, and if they apply for an H-1B, they can keep working it now until October 1st. And apparently they're now saying they can keep working for 6 months beyond that till April 1st, I guess, so they don't have to pay premium processing to get an H-1B. Little unclear. And they're also proposing to clarify the requirements regarding the requested start date on the petition to permit filing with request starts after October 1 of the relevant fiscal year. Now, they say that's consistent with current USCIS policy, but that's not true. That's a lie. They also focus on what's called program integrity. Now, I skipped ahead earlier as I was going through the regulation, where they basically say that their investigators in FDNS, by the way, which you have no legal duty to comply with under current policy. You don't have to answer any questions from FDNS if they show up and say, go on your way. We're not talking to you. And frankly, and generally speaking, it's in your best interest not to talk to these people. They said they found that in the last 3 years, 30% of the visits resulted in some sort of noncompliance or, quote, fraud. Whereas previous investigators had only found about 10 to 11% in previous years since 09. By codifying this, it's authority to request contracts. So what they're saying is they're going to make it your legal obligation to request contracts, if somebody's working on the contract, to require the petitioner established as actual non-speculative position in a specialty occupation available on the start date. This is to really contract to go against job shops who basically say, I'm going to apply for 50 H-1Bs. And in fact, they only have five jobs. And they also ensure that the LCA properly supports and corresponds to the mission. Why aren't they doing that now? And revise the definition of U.S. employer by codifying the existing requirement that the petitioner has a bona fide job offer to work in the U.S. I mean, it doesn't even make sense with current policy. Again, so much policy here, not law to follow. And adding the requirement that the petitioner have a legal presence and amenable to service or process in the U.S. I mean, how are they not doing that now? That's what doesn't make any sense. I assumed that it was always the case. They are also doing something that actually has been policy on and off for years, which is basically you can do a self-employed H-1B, that you can create your own company and file for an H-1B while they, quote, set reasonable conditions to ensure that the beneficiary owns a controlling interest in the petitioning entity. Okay. They're also going to codify their site visit authority and clarify that refusal to comply with site visits will result in denial or revocation. So right now, there's a lot of lawyers like me saying, don't comply with these site visits. They're not required. They're going to say, no, you got to do it. You got to do it. You know, that I think that's a gigantic waste of money and time, but they have to justify the Fraud Detection National Security Useless Office. They're clarified that an H-1B worker will be staffed to a third party. It requires the third party and not the petitioner to fulfill the requirements in determining whether the position is a specialty occupation. And that's to prevent fraud. So let's get into the details here of what they're talking about. Now, I do want to point you to a great blog by my dear friend Cyrus Mehta. who did an excellent deep dive into this regulation. I would also note, by the way, that 316 people have already commented on the regulations that are out there. And there's a 60-day time frame on the submission of comments here. And I would I'd strongly suggest you to take a look at them. They're fascinating. And it's some of them are good, some of them are bad. But let's look at the deep dive. There's a lot of people commenting on this. They of course say they have the authority to do this. We've got the authority to do this. You know, whatever. We're in charge, we're the boss. We can do what we want. So what the probably the most important thing, and I've harped on this, and Greg and I, excuse me, have harped on this on our lives with Impact Litigation, is that, and because we sued them over the H-1B lottery program, because it's fraudulent. I mean, the whole thing is just made up stuff. So now they're creating a new registration requirement that will be selected by beneficiary. So a beneficiary may have 10 employers file for them. They'd be legitimate employers. I don't know how that's even possible, but they will be selected by beneficiary. So this is going to reduce the number of duplicate applications filed, because you're only going to get picked by beneficiary. And it also is going to reduce the number of applications. So they're not going to get 750,000 applications this next year. My guess is they probably end up getting about, best guess, maybe 500,000, because if the beneficiary can sponsor themselves and then go look for a job, or can have an employer say, look, I'm going to file, will you be my sponsor? And then they can have another sponsor file for them. I mean, that might be a way to do this. But let's look at how they're going to run this program. All right. No, but before we get to that, I think the most important change here, besides that, is the specialty occupation change. And they admit here, as they say this proposed language, what they're going to say, it currently defines a specialty occupation as, quote, an occupation which requires a theoretical and practical application of a body of highly specialized knowledge in fields of human endeavor, including but not limited to architecture, engineering, mathematics, physical science, social sciences, medicine, health, education, business specialties, accounting, law, theology, and the arts, which require the attainment of a bachelor's degree or higher in a specific specialty or its equivalent as a minimum entry for occupation. So the proposed rule would add language saying that there must be a direct relationship between the required degree field and the duties of the position, that there may be more than one acceptable degree field for a specialty occupation, and that a general degree, like, I don't know, business, is insufficient. Good question. General, whatever a general degree is. Now, if we look at footnote 18, they actually cite to the Mankato case, which was my case that we worked on with Ayla, which says that if this is a quote that they cite, the record shows petitioner would consider someone as qualified position based on less than a bachelor's degree in specialized occupation, then it would not meet the statutory requirements. So they actually cite to the Mankato case, which they settled with us because they were going to lose. So let's go back up to that. Specifically, they're going to add the language clarifying that the required specialized studies must be directly related to position. Also proposes to add language that a position is not a specialty occupation if the attainment of a general degree, such as a business administration degree, without further specialization is sufficient to qualify for position. So all of the folks with a BCom degree, completely useless to get an H-1B under these new regulations. That's a specific change, because how many bachelor's degrees have a further specialization? None. A position for which or what about your degrees in computer science? Is that too general? I mean, what is computer science? A position for which a bachelor's degree is sufficient to qualify for a position would not be considered a specialty occupation if the degree is applicable to a wide variety of fields unrelated to the position. Now, this is kind of a crazy. Now, they cite to a case called CareMax, which, by the way, doesn't say that. So they cite to CareMax without actually quoting from CareMax. They also say the amended definition clarifies that a position would not qualify as a suspected occupation if the attainment of a general degree is sufficient to qualify for the position. And then, of course, the burden of proof is on the foreign national. They say this is consistent with the degree being a specific specialty and longstanding practice. That's horse manure. That's not true. And this is actually comes right out of the Trump rules to make H-1Bs harder to get. Now, they would also have to, as part of showing the direct relationship within the degree and the occupation and the duties of the occupation. They say, quote, in many cases, the relationship will be clear and relatively easy to establish. For example, it should not be difficult to establish that a medical degree is required for the duties of a physician. Yeah, but how many physicians have H-1Bs? I mean, there are some, but there's not 65,000. Similarly, the direct relationship between the duties of a lawyer and a law degree or an architect and an architectural degree, he said, in other cases, the direct relationship may be less apparent and may have to explain and provide documentation. So if you don't have a law, architecture, or medical degree, the cost of your H-1B just went up. And by the way, this will likely, even though they're putting deference in here, saying give deference, you do a renewal with a general BCom degree, you're going to be doing a lot of work, okay? They give another example. For the position of electrical engineer, a degree in electrical engineering or electronics may qualify for the position and therefore is the equivalent of the degree. That's crazy. If your degree is in electronics engineering and you're getting a job as electrical engineer, how is that not directly related to the degree? I mean, really, was a third grader write this stuff? And so they spent a lot of time talking about, for example, multiple disparate fields of study would not automatically disqualify somebody. Look at the body of highly specialized knowledge. So this is something that's going to be litigated out the wazoo as part of this. That's going to be, for example, a petition with a requirement of any engineering degree in any field of engineering for the position of software developer would generally not satisfy a statutory requirement. But they're approving them now. If an individual could qualify for a software developer position based on a seemingly unrelated engineering degree, then it cannot be concluded the position requires the application of a highly specialized body of knowledge and a degree in specific specialty. Okay. So amending the criteria for specialty occupations, they're also going to amend the rule and say normally does not mean always. So normally means conforming to a type, standard, or regular pattern characterized by usual, typical, common, or routine, but doesn't mean always. That actually is probably finally a good change, but also as a result of litigation that they kept losing. They're also amending it to add U.S. to a baccalaureate degree and replacing the word position with occupation such that the minimum requirement for entry into a particular position while eventually will be employed is a U.S. degree or its foreign equivalent, and that a foreign baccalaureate is not necessarily an equivalent. So that three-year degree is not going to be good enough. And they say, again, that codifies longstanding practice. See, they've been practicing outside the lines for a long time. They've been doing a lot of coloring outside the lines for a very long time. They're also consolidating the four criteria of an H-1B into three by consolidating the second prong into the fourth prong. The fourth prong of 214.2 H-4-3A-2 focuses on a position's complexity or uniqueness, and four, which focuses on a position's complexity and specialization. In practice, they're frequently consolidated in the same. It streamlines the criteria. That's not a bad amendment for purposes of this. I'm not going to challenge that. But they're also saying that the third criterion, saying that the employer normally requires a degree or its equivalent to, the employer normally requires a U.S. baccalaureate or higher degree in a directly related specific specialty or its equivalent. That's a big change. That's a big change. Because you can't say, well, we'll take a BCom and some experience. What they're saying here is you have to have the equivalent of a U.S. bachelor's degree. So this is that again, big change, part of the changes that the Trump administration put in. And I would note that Stuart Anderson also wrote a blog about this in Forbes this last week that you should take a look at. About these changes, and really talks about how a lot of these changes they're putting in here actually came from the proposed rules that the Trump administration copied almost verbatim in some cases from the proposed rules that Trump proposed that were struck down by a federal court. Okay, so that's out there. Now, DHS also is changing how you file an amended due to an application, due to a change in the place of employment. And they are saying that any change of work location that requires a new LCA, it's considered a material change and therefore requires an amended petition. So basically, if you're moving outside the metropolitan statistical area, you're going to, for where your LCA is, you're going to need to do a new H-1B. And also saying that a new petition is required for a short-term placement of H workers at a work site not listed on the approved petition or corresponding LCA. This actually is a change, a massive change. It's going to result in increased expenses for employers. Now, they spend a lot of time talking about the Simeo case here, saying that, where the AAL held that a change in geographic employment requires a new LCA. And they supposedly are simply codifying this. That has not always been the case. But it appears that if you move within an MSA, the metropolitan statistical area, you don't need a new H-1B. That's how I'm taking this petition. And they specifically say that moving to a new job location, a new area, does not require an amended petition. Good. And that's exactly what we're talking about. They're also saying that short-term placement of less than 30 days that do not require a new LCA also does not require a new movement. But if it's short-term, it's greater than 30 or in some cases 60 days, does require it. Now, they do make a change in regards to peripatetic jobs. These are jobs that basically, jobs primarily in one location, but you travel occasionally for jobs to other locations. The proposed change tries to make it consistent with the DOL regulations, which sets forth criteria for what's called a place of employment or work site, where you would not need a new H-1B, where the person is going to a non-work site location to participate in employee development while basically performing a peripatetic job. Okay, so that's a key change. Deference is their fourth thing. By the way, this regulation is 120 pages long, and we're not going to go through every page, but just the key highlights here. The new deference provision in here basically says, look, if you approved it previously, absent any indicia of fraud of some kind, you need to approve a new application. And you need to approve the new one. It should be basically automatic. But I will tell you a big change is now, in filing an H-1B extension, you have to submit evidence of maintenance of status. And this is true for E's, every E, including E3s, H's, every H, L's, O's, P's, Q's, R's, and TN's. And as we look at this, further provide evidence of maintenance status, including but not limited to copies of pay stubs, W-2 forms, quarterly wage reports, tax returns, contracts, and work orders. This is an insane paperwork requirement. How does this not violate the Paperwork Reduction Act? This is a big deal. This is going to hurt some people. And it's also going to cost a lot more money to file H-1Bs and H-1B extensions to gather all your W-2 forms, your pay stubs for the last 3 years. Hey, make sure you keep your pay stubs for the last 3 years. Hey, employer, I need your quarterly wage reports. Employer doesn't want to give their quarterly wage reports to the Immigration Service. and, you know, copies of their passports, travel documents, may submit last two pay stubs. Okay. Last two pay stubs, their W-2 or other evidence. You know, they're codifying these requirements. They're just making these requirements up. I think this is a terrible idea. This is, now they do say this, even when there was a prior determination, USAS does not need to give deference when there's a material error involving a prior approval. And we're dealing with this with a client right now where immigration is alleging a material error where there was no material error. And we're going to have to go into federal court on this to challenge them on this. So burden of proof, got that. So let's go to the next big change. And I think this is just going to be a massive paperwork. Eliminating the itinerary requirement for H program. So you don't need to put an itinerary where you're going to perform your travel. It's more than one location. That's a positive change. DHS proposes to allow H-1Bs to be approved or have their request approved. Dates extended if USS adjudicates and deems which approval after the initial request of validity period end date or their period for which the eligibility has passed. I mean, we're going to take so long to adjudicate your case that you, the date you requested will be expired, but we're still going to adjudicate it. They're doing that now. I think that's kind of silly. CAP exemptions, we mentioned this earlier, how they're expanding the definition of CAP exemption for nonprofit entity and nonprofit research institution. This is a positive change, and I welcome this, and it should be make for more people available to nonprofit H-1Bs. The CAP gap extension we talked about. So what they're basically saying is provide an automatic extension of duration of status and post-completion OPT or a 24-month extension of post-completion OPT until April 1 of the relevant fiscal year for which the H-1B is requested. So in the past, you've requested an October 1 start date and maybe immigration, and you can work till October 1 under the CAP gap policy. But let's say immigration doesn't adjudicate it. We see this all the time. Now you can work until April 1 of the following year, but of the same fiscal year. That actually is a pretty good change for F1s and a welcome change to part of the program. They're also changing the flexibility of a start date. Right now, you can only request an October 1 start date. The new rule allows you to request a later start date for the application. So petitioner may file an H-1B CAP on behalf of a registered beneficiary for a particular fiscal year only after registration is picked for that year. For the current registration, you can pick 6 months, and usually you pick October 1st. That language is now eliminated and provide flexibility and to employers to request a start date after October 1. Okay, so that's actually a pretty good change. Now you get to the program integrity for the H-1B registration system. So under this system, the proposed rule, they're going to allow multiple registrations, but not from the same employer. I mean, you can't have multiple from the same employer or related employers. Those are barred. Those will get all the applications stricken. But what they're going to do is pick by beneficiaries. They finally do reveal the hidden details behind the beneficiaries who filed multiple applications. Particularly for fiscal year 2022, 235,000 total beneficiaries for FY 2022. But for FY 2023, they had 307,000 singular beneficiaries, and 49,000 people filed duplicates as part of this. So we're going to see at least, I think it's going to be like 400,000 individuals, because at this point, if you can get an offer from an employer and you got a degree and you're going to be picked by registrant, why wouldn't you put your name in? So I think we're going to see about 400,000 registrations coming forward. And so immigration is going to pick by registrant. This is actually something that Greg talked about repeatedly over and over and over again for the last 2 years, something we suggested in our litigation back in 2021 to DOS, the DHS, which they just poo-pooed at the time. But it's good to see them get where we were 3 years ago. Happy to see them do the right thing. I mean, ultimately, maybe immigration does the right thing most of the time. Now, one thing that I do not see in this registration is the fee. Where's the new fee? And I'm kind of scrolling through here and not seeing any fee as part of this. So we know they're raising the fee from $10. They've already said that. So the question is what it's going to be. So that's not here. And the last thing I want to talk about, because I don't want to get too long-winded here, are the beneficiary owners. To codify that a petitioner's ability to qualify as a U.S. employer, even when the beneficiary possesses a controlling interest in the petitioner, is great for a lot of entrepreneurs graduating with an H-1B. Start your own company. This, because there was a memorandum that rescinded this policy, it requires, let's see, for entrepreneurs, one of the proposed conditions is they may perform duties that are directly related to owning and directing the business, so long as they perform specialty duty occupations a majority of the time. This is more than 50% of the time. They can also do non-specialty duty occupations to run their business part of the time, so that's okay. This actually is, I think this is probably the most impactful of all of the changes, because this is gonna open up an entrepreneurial streak in H-1B visa holders that is going to be fantastic. One of the big downsides is the implementation of site visits as mandatory compliance, which is going to suck as far as third party placements with mandatory visits and compliance. So this is this new rule, which, you know, they're gonna take comments. They may make some changes to some things, but there's some good things here. There's some bad things here as part of this. By the way, one thing I just noticed is they're proposing giving the beneficiaries of H-1Bs copies of all the receipt notices and approval notices to the beneficiary and not just the employer. About damn time that they're doing that. That's a good thing. So that's kind of our overview and our kind of where we are on the H-1B proposed rules. These are good things. You've got until December 25th or 24th. I think it's the 24th to get your comments in. We'll be doing a comment. ABLE, Alliance of Business Immigration Lawyers, ALA, will be doing comments and seeing if we can kind of fix some of the crazier stuff here, but also keep the good stuff. I'll be with you again next week. We'll be back on a regular schedule on our podcast, and it's great to be with you. Y'all have a great week. This is Chuck Cook here at Cook Baxter. If you have any questions about immigration, feel free to email me at chuck@immigration.net. Bye-bye.